Hey, howdy, hey, everyone, and welcome to episode 14 of Rudy's Roundup, an All Things Disney podcast. I, like always, am your host, Travis Rude, and today's episode is going to be a continuation of a previous episode. Today we welcome in Andy Rude, the host of the This Won't Teach You Anything podcast, and also better known as my brother, the lucky man that he is. Andy, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. And for those of you that have listened before, you'll know Andy was on my Star Wars podcast where we reviewed the first three movies. Not the original three released, but the first three, episodes 1, 2, and 3, where Andy gave some insight on his favorite Star Wars movie of all time, also known as episode 2. Correct, Andy?
That is incorrect. I would delete that movie from canon if I could, but I can't. So it sits there as a reminder of negative thoughts abound.
Gotcha. That's strong words, sir. Strong words. Reminds me of Billy Madison. That is wrong. Where he gives the final answer.
Yep. May God have mercy on your soul.
So today we're going to be talking about episode 4. And the reason we kind of divided it up from doing 4, 5, and 6 was because I know Andy is a huge fan of 4, 5, and 6. After all, that's what got him started when he first saw it. So episode 4, I'm sure you'll have a ton to say about, as well as episode 5 and 6. So we're going to dive into that and go over a few topics, such as one of my favorite, as I researched this episode, was the casting options and reading some of the names that were looked at for some of the characters, especially the Han Solo character. And Andy, we'll talk about that later, but had you heard some of these when we, in our research and some of the documents I've shared with you, had you heard some of these characters that had auditioned for it?
Yeah, I'd heard of some of them. Some of them were a surprise because I hadn't looked at this in a while. But yeah, definitely a few of them, you know, kind of make the rounds in Star Wars fandom and what might have been. I think, you know, as we talk about it, Saturday Night Live even did a skit on alternate castings or the audition process for Star Wars. So, that was kind of good. One of the names on one of these lists was portrayed as auditioning for a certain character. And so that's pretty funny.
Yes. And when I was doing research, I saw the YouTube video of one of the guys that we'll talk about. They posted on YouTube the actual audition. So we'll kind of get into that. So without further ado, come along with us on episode 14 of Rudy's Roundup. So today we talk about Star Wars: A New Hope, which we'll talk about the title, A New Hope, a little bit later as one of the changes that was made after the movie was released. So the original release date was May 25th, 1977, on a budget of $11 million. Seems big back then, seems very, very tiny right now. As of January 21st, the box office gross total, $775.3 million. A couple things about the release when it came out. One thing I learned was it was a limited release of about 34 theaters, and which I found Chewie loves Star Wars. Hey, there we go, Chewie. That's my Saint Bernard in the background.
On cue.
He knows exactly who's talking. So it was released to 34 theaters and went on to obviously hit nationwide release and worldwide release.
Yeah, let me jump in here real quick. Yeah. Since we're talking the dog, it's not it's semi-related to Star Wars, but a little tidbit of trivia is, since Chewie has decided to make his debut, George Lucas, do you know what his dog's name was?
I believe, if I remember right, wasn't it Indiana?
It was a husky named Indiana. So there's kind of the inspiration for Indiana in Indiana Jones was George Lucas's dog, and they even worked that into Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where Sala makes a joke. Sean Connery reminds Indiana that, or Indiana tells him that I like Indiana, not Henry Jones Jr. And Sean Connery tells him we named the dog Indiana. So, yeah, that little thing there, just for Chewie.
Excellent. He was excited to be on the podcast finally. He'd been waiting his turn. So let me correct myself. It's 32 theaters, not 34. So the film opened on a Wednesday in 32 theaters, expanding to 43 screens on the Friday after its initial release and earning $2.5 million in its first 6 days to the end of the Memorial Day weekend. So quite impressive for being a small number of screens. And when you saw it, Andy, when was your first time seeing it?
You know, it's tough to remember. I have better memories of seeing episode 5 because I was a little older,
yeah,
in 1980. Bits and pieces, but one of the things that I remember about it was that it was just something, you know, even at the age that I was, and so young, it was just, I think a lot of the things on film, you know, with the laser blast and things like that tend to grab your attention. You don't quite know what you're seeing, but you know, it's colorful. You know, there's a lot of sound and with, you know, just maybe not understanding what's going on with the story, you can still pick up on, you know, the emotion through the visuals and the sound that you're seeing and the music. And so, you know, that's what I remember the most initially, was all of the visual and audio that took place in it. So it's on repeated viewings, and on episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back, where I have like stronger memories, but I've seen episode 4 more than I've seen any of the other films.
Now, when you remember seeing it, and even episode 5, stormtroopers, they just never got the accuracy point down, did they?
No, and that's Ben Kenobi in there early in episode 4 talks about these blast points being too precise for sand people. Only Imperial stormtroopers are that precise. And so that he's maybe giving them too much credit, because by this point he'd fought in the Clone Wars, where the battle droids were terrible shots, and that kind of continued on to stormtroopers in that aspect. Yeah, they were not good shots.
So it was just more of how many can we throw at you, and one of them is going to hit something if we get enough of these stormtroopers.
Yeah, quantity over quality. They looked cool.
They did. They looked awesome, and I was always a fan of the Imperial Guard, wasn't it? The red?
Yeah, the Emperor's Guard.
Yes.
Yeah, they showed up in episode 5 for the first time, is where you saw those guys.
Those guys were awesome.
Yeah, very well designed.
Within 6 months into release, getting back to just how big this became in its initial release, it replaced Jaws as the highest earning film in North America after just 6 months, eventually earning over $220 million during its initial theatrical run. So, huge. And that was one thing I didn't know. I didn't know Jaws up until that point was the highest grossing movie in North America.
Yeah, which I believe might have been the last time an R-rated film was the highest grossing movie in the country.
Do you know what bypassed Star Wars? I'll give you a hint. 1982.
1982.
And it had to do with also kind of out of this world.
E.T.
Yes, that's correct. You are correct, sir.
That's funny, because Spielberg did Jaws. His very good friend George Lucas did Star Wars. And then Spielberg did E.T.
I'll top that. Give me that. So you look at, like I said, the success. You see all the success, and that just didn't translate to commercial release. That translated to critical acclaim. The critical acclaim was was very positive when it came out. And also what a lot of moviegoers, or I'm sorry, movie makers and studios look for is the award season. It was nominated for 11 Academy Awards and won 7. So it did very, very well at the Academy Awards. Excuse me. And some of those that you think of that it won, best score, obviously. Andy, let's talk about that, because I know you're a huge fan of John Williams.
Yes.
So what did you think about it, just as Star Wars as a whole? I mean, even the music. I mean, you have characters like Han Solo. You've got Darth Vader. You've got the Emperor, R2-D2. You've got characters that have lived with us through our entire lives, thanks to, you know, good re-releases where they've brought it back into the forefront, where they've made the original prequel, then they've made the 7-8-9 trilogy. But not only do you have characters, you've got props, the Millennium Falcon, the X-Wing, you've got those things, but also you've got the music. So talk a little bit about that score of Episode 4, or even just Star Wars in general.
Yeah, I'm going to go out and I'm going to say, you know, as a fan of film and especially Star Wars, and so I'm maybe a bit biased, but I don't think you're going to find more people that disagree than agree that John Williams' original Star Wars score is not the best score of all time. That is arguably the most recognizable theme in history. For me, and you know, John Williams, his nickname, I mean, you know, they call conductors maestro, but his nickname is the maestro. And it's just, you know, the way he composes and whatnot, they're just so memorable. And term that always comes to mind is, you know, heroic. It just, his composition is always so right on. I mean, if you go, I encourage anybody who has seen Star Wars, which I would imagine would be 100% of your audience, or, you know, just seen it once, to, you know, find a copy on your streaming service, and a copy somewhere, but that would be probably the most readily available, and just listen to it. It takes you through the film, and you can feel, you can close your eyes and kind of feel where you are in the film. You can, you know, if it's Princess Leia's theme, that's going to be something that if you're a Star Wars semi-fan, to where you've watched the films a couple times and whatnot, you're going to hear that and you're going to think, oh, I remember hearing that, but you may not know what it sounds like right now. You know, he was really big on character themes. Binary Sunset, that's the one. Again, listen to that. You're going to hear it and you're going to go, that's what that is. There's just so many things. And one of the ones that didn't hit on Episode 4 that is arguably probably top two, maybe right behind the Star Wars theme, is the Imperial March.
Yes.
And that right there, I mean, as much as the Star Wars theme and the throne room theme at the end of Star Wars is heroic, the Imperial March is you can just, you know, it's not a theme for a good guy. You know, it's very bass heavy, and it's very it just exudes kind of a darkness.
Yes.
Which it should, being the dark side of the Force kind of thing. So yeah, for me, John Williams, Star Wars, Episode 4, and you can listen to any of them because they're all fantastic. Even Episode 1 had Duel of the Fates, which is another fantastic piece. But, you know, if I'm recommending, you know, just a few tracks right off the top of my head, that the Star Wars theme, and listen to it on a good set of headphones or on a good sound system, and you're going to get the full benefit. If you can find it on vinyl, even better. Star Wars theme, Binary Sunset, Princess Leia's theme, and the throne room. I forget the exact title, but it's, I believe, the last track on there. But the throne room one was actually one I used in my wedding Yes. When my wife and I walked in to the reception hall. So that may be a little self-indulgent, but I like the track, so that's what we did. I don't know how much of a fan she was, but she went with it.
I'm sure she loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you were there. So, yeah, I mean, just listen to those to get a real sense of what John Williams' writing was about. And I could go on and on about him, you know, but there's still with us, I believe, around 93, 94 years old. And he did do the scores for all of the episodic Star Wars films. So that's excluding Rogue One and Solo and the Clone Wars film. The animated Clone Wars film that was out, he didn't do those or The Mandalorian or that type of thing, but anything with an episode behind it, he went ahead and did the score. Now, I think all the films, maybe Solo did not, but I believe Rogue One may have used the Star Wars theme in the credits at the end. But, yeah, so John Williams, best ever. If you wanted your film to have lasting success, you should contact on John Williams and have him do the score. I'm sure he'd be fine with it.
John, what are you doing right now? Yeah, I got a movie. Need you to whip up some music. And you said something that rang true. Just because I was on Facebook the other day, and you know, there's all these memes and things like that, but. Somebody posted a picture of Alan Adale, who's the rooster from Robin Hood, and he was voiced by Roger Miller.
I saw this one.
Yes, and it says something to the effect of, oh, what was it?
I think it was, it basically said, if someone tells you a picture can't go ahead and make sound.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Yep.
And it doesn't make sound.
Exactly. Show me a picture that made sound or something to that effect. And obviously for me, huge Robin Hood fan, I knew.
Oh, I heard it immediately too, mainly because I think you watched that film one summer almost every day.
Yes. Yep. Mom reminds me of that summer. Just kept going. And when you said that about John Williams, you know, just you hear a song and it takes you to a point in a movie. You show me the opening credits and boom, there, you know, you just hear. You know that there's something amazing going to happen, and whether it's, you know, the Tantina scene or like when you named it, my mind immediately went to Darth Vader, the Imperial March. You know that dude's a bad dude, and you just see everything focuses. That music drives your attention right towards Darth Vader, and John Williams has done amazing with. Like you said, bringing attention to what is actually happening. So you don't need to be watching the movie. Like you said, if you get the score and you're listening to it, you know exactly, oh yeah, I know what's going on here. And you can just sit there and rewatch the movie in your mind based on what song is going.
Yeah. And, you know, he's just an absolute master of things, you know, not just what's going on the screen, but of who the characters are that have a theme. And it's so evident through different things. And I'm going to talk John Williams in general, if that's all right, for just a second. But I mean, when you go ahead, another one to listen to is the theme from Jurassic Park. That's a John Williams piece.
Okay.
And that to me, when I hear that, it starts off very quiet. And kind of softly builds into a louder crescendo, and it just speaks as to when I hear it. It sounds like what you would hear if you were coming around the corner and saw, you know, one of the big herbivore dinosaurs, one that you were in no danger of, but just it's got an awe, and it's just like it is in the film where Sam Neill and Laura Dern see that first. Brachiosaurus. And so when the music just says that, it just is, it's very soft and grows into that kind of a wonder. And it does so well for that. It fits so well, you know, something like, you know, Jurassic Park could have had a vastly different sound or a vastly different theme if it was somebody else composing it. Maybe it would have worked fine. But then you've got another one. You mentioned Jaws. He did the Jaws theme, and that was perfect. It was very laid back compared to what he's done for Jurassic Park, for Star Wars. But you know, that's just him knowing what it, you know, what's going on watching the film. Now imagining watching these films without any score. You know, because the score is done late in the game after the film's done, so that the music can coincide with what's going on the screen and capture the emotions audially that you want it to have, aside from just what's visually going on. So, you know, but imagine that, watching a movie and you don't think about it too much, but, you know, if you took the music out of a film, it would probably lose a little bit. The another one would be the Raiders March.
Yes.
Which is basically is the theme to the Indiana Jones films. And, you know, that's a very heroic theme, but again, it starts off just kind of simple. And for me, that perfectly captures Indiana Jones. This guy is always seems to get in over his head. And he's, you know, he's not, you know, I mean, he's a really smart guy, but doesn't, you know, he just is very reactionary. And so it's not like, you know, he's James Bond with all the gadgets and all this kind of stuff. He has to make things happen. And he's kind of like, you know, an everyday guy that gets in these situations and has to find a way out. But yeah, John Williams, perfect at capturing emotion of a scene, emotion of a character, and what things, who the people are and what is going on screen. But he does it in sound.
Perfect. And I'd said 11 Academy Award nominations and 7 wins. So just let me go through these and just to give a grasp of how popular this movie was. So it was nominated for Best Picture, nominated for Best Director, nominated for Best Supporting Actor, which would have been Andy.
That would have been Alec Guinness.
That's right.
As Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yep. Best Original Screenplay, it was nominated. And then here's where it won. Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Score, Best Production Design, Best Sound Mixing, Best Visual Effects, and then a Special Achievement Academy Award. So you look at how successful it was commercially and during award season, and what you get, what I see with these nominations are just how totally encompassing the film was for success. Sure, you've got an amazing space movie, you know, with ships and blasts and things like that. Obviously, you're going to see some visual effects, sound mixing award nominations or wins, things like that. But you have that along with costume design. You know, you've got a bunch of aliens. Sure, you're going to see some stuff like that. But then you win Best Score. You're nominated for Best Picture. You're nominated for Screenplay. You're nominated for Best Director. So you take a look at just the range of success this had and realize, you know, how important it was as a movie, both to regular moviegoers and also to those that judge movies, that award movies, things like that. Just amazing when it came to how successful it was. And we move on to another award. And in 1989, there were 25 films picked to be selected for preservation by the National Film Registry of the United States Library of Congress. And the 1977 theatrical release of Star Wars was one of those 25 to be selected for preservation. And that is just basically, Andy, have you followed some of the movies that have been there, or, you know, that whole process of the film registry?
I have, probably not as closely, but go ahead and we'll see what happens.
That original list was made up, like I said, of 25 films. And what it was basically them saying that this movie was culturally significant enough to be preserved for lack of a better term, for all time. So this list includes, as the National Film Registry and the Library of Congress describe it, as culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant and worthy of preservation. So here are some of the films on that list. And keep in mind, these were the first 25 picked. So they went through and picked 25 films from the beginning of film to that point in 1989. How many of those do you think you've seen?
Go ahead and list them again. I'll tell you if I've seen them.
Yeah. So we've got The Best Years of Our Lives from 1946.
I have not seen it.
A small movie called Casablanca from 1942.
One of my favorites.
Citizen Kane from 41.
I have seen it.
The Crowd from 1928.
Have not.
Dr. Strangelove from 1964.
I have.
Unique movie. The General from 1927.
I have not.
You ever hear this one? Gone with the Wind, I think it's pronounced, 1939.
Another favorite of mine.
The Grapes of Wrath, 1940.
I have.
High Noon, 1952. Yep. Intolerance, 1916.
Nope.
The Learning Tree, 1969.
Nope.
The Maltese Falcon, 1941. Yes. Great movie. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 1939. Yep. Modern Times, 36.
No.
Nanook of the North, 1922.
Nope.
On the Waterfront, 1954. Yes. The Searchers, 56.
Yes.
Singing in the Rain, 52.
Yes.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. If you say no, you can't be on this podcast. We're ending it now.
Yep.
1937. Some Like It Hot, which strikes a chord with you. 1959.
Yeah, Marilyn Monroe. That is a movie that if you haven't seen, comedically, was probably very, very, very racy back when it came out in, God, what was it, 59?
Yep. That's right, 59.
Was very probably racy, but probably would fit into these times just fine. Has to do with cross-dressing and just things that you probably didn't, you know, were probably not as accepted as they are today.
Yep.
And so, and it's in black and white too. So it just, you know, people today would go ahead and get a kick out of it because I think it holds up well comedically and situationally. Although it takes place, I think the film was, it's from 1959, but the film maybe takes place earlier than that. I can't remember right off. Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, Marilyn Monroe. Very, very good.
All right. Star Wars, obviously, 77. Mm-hmm. Sunrise, 1927.
Nope.
Sunset Boulevard, 1950.
Yes.
Vertigo, 58.
Yes.
And The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
1939.
So yeah, I'm 75% about.
What are your thoughts on, obviously for me, you know, I look at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Uh-huh.
You know, being the first full-length animated feature film. And obviously when you look at the terms or how they chose these, being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, you know, you want this film, in this case Snow White, in there because, like I said, first full length was a huge success. Nobody thought it would be. Everybody kind of criticized Walt for spending all the money that he did to make a full length cartoon, is what they, you know, said at the time. But you look at some of these other movies, The Searchers, huge John Wayne fan, huge Searchers movie that has gained more and more, I would say, more respect. Not that it was ever disrespected, but when the top 100 movies of all time first came out, I think in maybe 99 or 2000, it was number 88. And then in 2010, they redid the list, and it moved all the way up to number 11. And so, you know, just 10 years, it moved up to what they considered the 11th greatest movie. The AMA considered the 11th greatest movie of all time. But you've got Gone with the Wind, The Grapes of Wrath, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, if you haven't seen that one. Jimmy Stewart, great movie, just about politics, about, you know, a normal guy heading to politics and learning the insides of it and watching what it does to him and that process. But when you think of Star Wars being grouped with some of these movies, your Gone with the Winds, your Casablancas, what does that mean to you as a huge fan of Star Wars?
I think it's rightfully deserved. I mean, you heard the Academy Award listing. I know there's some people that don't put a lot of stock into the Academy Awards, but, you know, art's subjective, and so it's tough to go ahead and quantify what is the best out because people have different tastes. So, you know, people, the thing with art, you can't look at something and say this is the best painting ever. You can prefer it to other paintings. It can be more popular because of run that it's got throughout history. I think if anybody asked what's the best painting ever, 99% of the people are going to say the Mona Lisa.
Yep.
Because it's the one everyone knows. And they might be right. That might be the best painting ever. But to somebody else, they're not going to like that painting. They're going to like, you know, Van Gogh's Sunflowers. To them, that's the best painting ever. So there's plenty of people out there that don't like Star Wars, and that's cool. And they're going to feel that it doesn't belong on there, but you can't go ahead and argue the requirements of what that list were, you know, the cultural impact. There's few films on that list that had the cultural impact that Star Wars did. I would say the ones that would be up there would be Snow White, for the reasons you mentioned, being a groundbreaking achievement in film, you know, and very similar to George Lucas's story with Star Wars. You know, Walt sunk a ton of money into that.
Yep.
And it was a big gamble. And nobody's ever done this. It's not going to work. You know, George Lucas sunk a ton of his own money in it so that he could into Star Wars, so he could maintain control of the film he wanted to make without, you know, you hire investors and, you know, they're going to have a say on how their money is spent. He didn't want any outside influence. So he did it all. And it was a huge gamble. So I would say Snow White. I would say The Wizard of Oz, which flopped when it came out.
Yep.
And I would say, probably Gone with the Wind, because of the scale, of a motion picture that was, and the shooting techniques and special effects that it had, the burning of Atlanta, you know, those were huge achievements back in, I think, 39. Those are the types of films I think off of that list that, you know, there's reasons that, you know, they're still going to be talked about, you know, years from now, you know, when they're looked at. It's just a different form of art. And those to me are the standouts, completely on that list. You know, I mean, you'll notice, I think, with The Searchers, there is a scene in episode 2 that it almost an exact shot that John Ford used in The Searchers that Lucas repeats in episode 2. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
There is a shot. I'll send it to you. You can put a link to it in your show notes. It's very interesting. So that, you know, that's just kind of a Easter egg of Lucas's thoughts on John Ford.
That's awesome. That would be a great tie-in for me. You know, I like the Star Wars movies, and then The Searchers, like, I can't talk about that movie enough as far as what a great movie it was. So we've discussed how successful it was, but also the lasting impact of it. Heck, you just heard my dog Chewie make his appearance, so that's still going. But a couple things that I wanted to bring up that my mind, when you were talking about things like John Williams, that went through my mind were, John Williams is called the maestro, and my mind immediately went to Seinfeld.
The maestro.
Why is he talking to a guy with a cape?
It was Larry David.
Yep. But yeah, the maestro, oh my Lord. But you see things like that are just still talked about today and in passing. And I've been rewatching on streaming How I Met Your Mother. And it's ironic, when you and I were talking about filming this, I just watched the episode titled Architecture of Destruction. Okay. And for those of you that haven't seen it, it's season 6, episode 5. And the opening is Barney Stinson, who's one of my favorite characters in TV. He's talking to Ted about four words that Ted needs to live his life by, and that is, new is always better. And so to test this, Ted asked a couple questions, and one of them being, so since new is always better, the new Star Wars, at that time would have been 1, 2, and 3, the new Star Wars are better than the original Star Wars. Okay. And Barney, who if you've seen the series, will stick to his guns no matter what until he doesn't.
That's good advice.
Yes. He says, so Ted says, so those new Star Wars movies, those are better than the old ones. Barney replies, yeah, the first three barely mention the intricacies of intergalactic trade law. So that's a cultural reference that I get that he used to stick with his argument of new is always better. But of cultural impact, Andy, what are some things that you see still to this day, whether it's, you know, talking to us, you know, me and Ort and Snakes and those guys, or some things that you may have come across that still resonate as a Star Wars fan that you see Star Wars in, whether it be everyday life or on TV or referenced somehow that makes you go back and say, yep, you know, Star Wars is still around.
You know, you see it everywhere. I think one of the more interesting places is, it's not as interesting now because it's so mainstream, but you know, when it came out was the merchandise. Star Wars completely changed. George Lucas completely changed merchandising, and in a lot of ways invented it with film tie-ins on Star Wars. That was one of the big things that he was way ahead of the game on. I mean, so many things, dialogue, not so much, but the merchandising and tie into the film, he saw opportunity there where none of the studios ever had. You know, he wanted merchandising rights and all that, and got them all. Again, financing his own film, but maintained control of all of that, all the images, all the, you know, any coffee mug, any action figure, any T-shirt. That was all him. And so nowadays, if you go and you buy a Iron Man shirt, or, you know, for a long time, there just wasn't any value in any of that because nobody put a lot of thought into doing that. You know, there was a lot of, you know, there'd be a bigger marketing budget you'd have to push, you know, who really wanted this stuff. He saw it and decided to pursue it. So anytime you go in there and buy something based off of a film or a TV show, it's basically George Lucas that was the brainchild of really pushing that stuff forward. So I think that might be one of the biggest cultural impacts. I think there's, you know, if you did a list of greatest or most memorable movie lines of all time, May the Force Be With You should be near or at the top of that list. You know, there's, you know, Here's Looking at You, Kid, that would be up there. I've Got a Bad Feeling About This, another Star Wars, which is said in every Star Wars film by a different character. You know, there's just so many memorable scenes in there that, and ship designs. You know, one of the things that made Star Wars so unique to me is, you know, you always had, you know, you think of sci-fi and you think of, you know, flashy, new looking, futuristic things. But, you know, in Star Wars, these were, you know, the dwellings, the ships, unless you were Imperial, which I think I've talked about before, the Imperial side did have the new things, you know, they're showing that, you know, clearly making out the rebellion as the underdogs.
Yes.
Their ships were recycled. They were old. They were beat up. They wouldn't start. They would shut down in the middle of a, you know, a hyperdrive wouldn't engage, that type of thing. So, you know, it really sold the good guy, the David versus Goliath type of thing that many films had done before that. So that's nothing new. But it introduced things to us, you know, lightsabers. Another thing, Ben Burtt, who did the sound on the films, you know, that's just something else. As much as John Williams is intricate to the musicianship, the score, the composing of the film, the sounds, I mean, there's iconic sounds, and how many films can you say that about?
That's a good call.
Right?
That's a good call.
I mean, I would say a large portion of anybody who enjoys films would know what the ignition of a lightsaber sounds like.
Yep.
Immediately, and waving it around and the sound it makes. You know, that's just, it's iconic. I mean, there's so many different things in Star Wars, Episode 4. I mean, just that film alone, that if, you know, Darth Vader's breathing,
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You know, the respiration in there. I mean, how many more iconic things can you fit into one film? You know, it just is... It just transcends so many things. And it was, it literally was, you know, you people say lightning in a bottle. Well, there was about four or five lightning bolts in that bottle on Star Wars.
Absolutely.
And it just is, there's a reason it's held up. And, you know, I think with Disney, I think their plan, and you can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but I think their plan is to really focus more along the lines of the streaming episodes.
Yeah, the miniseries. Yep.
Yeah. Which is fine, because I'll tell you what, The Mandalorian is some of the best Star Wars to come out in a long time.
Oh yeah. With the critical and commercial success of The Mandalorian, Disney's talked about that's their game plan. You know, they want to have by 2023, they want to have at least 100 original series a year, you know, across their entire platform of streaming. And what a way to start off, you know, Disney Plus. Mm-hmm. The Mandalorian just, you know, knocked it out of the park. And they've had some hiccups with some of the other ones that they've talked about doing, whether it be casting or whether it be story writing direction. And we'll kind of touch on those in a future episode. But you look at The Mandalorian and what it did for Disney Plus already. Disney Plus already has 100 million subscribers, and I guarantee you a lot of those, you know, were very, very much anticipating The Mandalorian and then coming back if they did cancel it for season two, you know, only to renew it for that. So it's definitely their way of thinking. Yes, you're still going to see blockbusters, but when it comes to the Star Wars side of things, you saw the graphic from their...
What they've got coming up.
Exactly. The upcoming. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's crazy to think about all the Star Wars directions they're going.
Yeah. Well, it's not too crazy when you figure they paid $4 billion for the property.
They need to make some of that money back.
Yeah. I think they've done all right I think they made it back on the sequels. But the, you know, the thing is, one of the things that I see, and this again speaks to the culture and the obsession that some people have with this, with Star Wars is, you know, I see a lot of, as I've said before, Star Wars fandom can be some of the most toxic fans ever. And it shifts as to, you know, what they want to be toxic on. I'm more accepting of things. As much as I hate episode two, I don't seriously want it redone. You know, it's a part of the story. It's just not one I prefer. You know, I mean, it's part of the journey. There's parts of journeys that you don't like. Nobody likes driving through Omaha, Nebraska. I'm sorry if you're from Omaha, Nebraska. I'm sure people don't like driving through Fort Wayne, Indiana. So
way to alienate those people. Thanks.
It's not my show. So I accept that, you know, but you'll see these ridiculous petitions for Disney to go ahead and redo episodes 7, 8, and 9, you know. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're not going to do that. But the thing about it is, or, you know, Disney ruined Star Wars. Sorry. I was there when the first movies came out. I was there when episodes 1, 2, and 3 came out. And I'm here when 7, 8, and 9 came out. And 1, 2, and 3, if Star Wars survived those, they're going to survive 7, 8, and 9. Without Disney getting involved, you're not getting The Mandalorian. You're not getting the last season of the Clone Wars animated series. You're not getting all of these shows they have coming up. You're not getting the Kenobi series that's coming up. That's going to start that's shooting now. That's got Ewan McGregor attached. You're not getting all this. So for anybody saying Disney ruined Star Wars, tell me what was going on with Star Wars before Disney got a hold of them.
That's a great point. Yeah, that's a great point. And we talked about, I wanted to touch on a couple things of the cultural significance. When you brought up lightsabers and sound, Disney has made money off of literally the term pew pew. They've got shirts at Disney World that you can buy from the stormtroopers, you know, blasters. They've got hats that say it. You take a literally two words, you stitch a stormtrooper on a shirt, and boom, you're selling like crazy. You put that phrase on a hat. What, like you said, what can you say that about where you can literally put something like that on a hat and start selling it right off the bat? The other thing, and for those of you wondering, my brother does live in Fort Wayne here with me. Not with me, but in Fort Wayne. But he might, I don't know, he's a little older than me, but he might take a chance. Back in 2019, and it got put on hold because of COVID, but 2019, the official fencing body of France recognized lightsaber dueling as a sport. So,
well, it should be. It should have been from the beginning.
You can go on YouTube and you can find videos of training sessions and things like that of officially recognized lightsaber dueling. And I'm not going to lie, it's pretty cool to see. Just again, some touch base on the cultural significance of what Disney has meant to millions and millions of people. So, like I talked about earlier, we're talking about casting options. And this is one thing I wanted to touch on because I find stuff like this fascinating. And I wanted to touch on the main three when it comes to Leia, Luke, and Han. So Luke, from the research that I did, there were some other ones that got it, but one of the closest ones that nailed the audition, from what I read and was strongly considered, was William Catt.
Mm-hmm.
Andy, are you familiar with that name?
Ah, the greatest American hero.
Yes, yet another Seinfeld type of tie-in.
Yep.
Also, one more thing on Seinfeld. Andy, do you remember the name Todd Gack from Seinfeld?
I don't.
Okay. So he was the one that made a bet with... He was the crazy bet guy that made a bet with Elaine, and his was he bet Elaine that Dustin Hoffman was in Star Wars. And... And Jerry had to pull her aside and tell her, you know, he made an unwinnable bet with you just so he could get a date with you. The date was, if he wasn't in Star Wars, he'd take her to dinner. Clever move by Todd Gack.
Yeah.
Clever.
Todd Gack.
Legend. William Catt, greatest American hero, was strongly considered for Luke Skywalker. Now, with casting, Andy, and you've told me this kind of story, George Lucas wanted, wasn't it newer faces, or what's the theory behind, or the story behind that?
Well, it's what he traditionally has done since Star Wars. I think he had thrown his hat personally behind actually Al Pacino for Han Solo. But what ended up happening, I mean, if we're talking Han Solo right now, if you want to list some of the actors.
Yeah. Yeah. Han Solo, and correct me if I'm wrong, didn't he bring in Harrison Ford to read with these guys?
Harrison Ford had been in American Graffiti.
Yep.
That George Lucas did, but on he was working at the time as a carpenter. Harrison Ford was. And so they needed somebody to read opposite. It might have been Carrie Fisher. I'd have to look. I don't think it was Mark Hamill, but I think it was Carrie Fisher. Or somebody for the Princess Leia character. And, you know, he happened to be there. So they just like, hey, could you read so we can, we can run this and view it. And so, you know, he was, you know, kind of pissy that he wasn't being considered for the part. So kind of read it like Han Solo type of thing that you see on the film. And that's what got him the part. That's what sold George Lucas on him, because he's like, when he saw that, that was Han Solo.
That's awesome. And the rest is history. So, mm-hmm. You know, you talked character or casting options. Some of the names that I came up when reading, Kurt Russell, and he's the one that mm-hmm. you can find on YouTube. You can find his line reading.
Screen test.
Yes.
Yeah.
Christopher Walken, who according to, I'll have to look for it and post it in the show notes. There was a book that talked about this. Christopher Walken would have been, after all the auditions, would have been their choice. He was their second choice, which, all right, unique. Robert Englund, for those of you, Andy, you want to fill in Robert Englund for those fans that may be listening that don't know Robert Englund?
Freddy Krueger.
That's right. And the tie-in also with Robert Englund was he was very good friends with Mark Hamill, and he urged Mark Hamill to go in and audition for the movie, which Mark Hamill obviously won the role of Luke Skywalker. Also, Tom Selleck, but that one is unconfirmed. From what I could find, there's always been rumors of it, but neither Lucas or Selleck ever confirmed that they did it.
Tom Selleck would have been Indiana Jones. You can find that screen test.
Yes.
He might have even screen tested with Karen Allen, who is Marion Ravenwood. But he would have been Indiana Jones, but his contract on Magnum PI, he couldn't get out of it.
Man.
So they went with the second choice, Harrison Ford.
Ah. Darn yep. it. I guess that worked.
That was Tom Selleck's to lose.
And Burt Reynolds also, and Nick Nolte. So those are some of the more prominent names that I kept coming up over and over with. Some of the names that I saw, like you said, Al Pacino, I saw that. Some of the names that I couldn't find a ton on, Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, you know, those things. So if you can fill in any of the blanks on any of the ones we listed, or stuff you've seen of, like I said, Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, anything you may have come across.
Did you mention Sylvester Stallone?
I did not.
Yeah, there. You know, some of this, over the years, things grow legs, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, how many of these? George Lucas is probably the only one that could go ahead and tell you who was fully considered. Interesting part out of that, you know, with Nick Nolte, he did finally, is part of the Star Wars canon now. After The Mandalorian, he did the voice of Quill.
Yes.
You know, these actors you've mentioned, I think he's the only one that has been in Star Wars. Of the ones we've talked about, I don't believe any of the other ones have been. Yeah, I aside from, you know, some of the more well-known stories that you have, I don't have any other stories about this because there's not film on everybody. And, you know, a lot of it's just kind of, you know, taken legs over the years as to whether it happened or not.
And Nick Nolte was one of those that in the story that I read, he basically agreed, or he basically told George Lucas, yeah, this probably isn't the best part for me, you know, after auditioning. And it made sense. I mean, you know, from what you see of who Han Solo is to so many people, you love an actor that after auditioning, you know, has the courage to say, yeah, this this isn't working.
Yeah, and I, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, how much the shadow of Harrison Ford's Han Solo loomed over the movie Solo.
Yep.
Right. Because the movie itself, it's a good action movie. You know, it's hard seeing anyone else as Han Solo. And I understand it's a younger version and whatnot, but you still have to capture some of the arrogance and some of the, you know, that Han Solo brought to the, or that Harrison Ford brought to the screen. And it does some of that, but it, you know, it's tough. That's an iconic character. You know, Darth Vader's showed up in Rogue One, and that worked to perfection. But it's a lot easier when it's a guy in a suit.
Yes,
Darth Vader still looks like Darth Vader, and when you've got the legendary James Earl Jones still doing the voice, it's still by all appearances Darth Vader. Chewie does not agree.
Yeah, Chewie's not a fan of Darth Vader. Man, no. This dog knows his cues.
Yep.
So, obviously, Harrison Ford, Han Solo, Princess Leia. Mm-hmm. So, some of the names I researched and looked up that kept popping up. Karen Allen.
Yep.
Andy.
Marion Ravenwood.
Yeah, there we go. Jodie Foster.
Okay. Farrah
Fawcett and Sigourney Weaver.
Okay, I have heard of some of those. I've also heard Glenn Close, Jessica Lange, Sissy Spacek, Sybil Shepherd.
Oh, wow.
Jane Seymour, Angelica Houston, Kim Basinger, Kathleen Turner, Gina Davis, Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep.
Yeah. Huh. Again, you know, it, who knows, right? I think many of those actresses could have done a great job of making Princess Leia their own, but it would be hard, as with Han Solo, hard for me to see anybody else in that role other than what Carrie Fisher did with it. She was way ahead of the time. You know, you saw a lot of side eyeing the moment in Avengers Endgame where you had all the female heroes kind of take a shot at Thanos.
Yep.
There's that scene, you know, and it's like, you know, why does that bother people?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it was a cool shot. I mean, how many times do you see all the guys there? Right.
Right.
You know, I mean, I thought it was a cool shot. Princess Leia in her own rescue is bossing around Luke Skywalker and Han Solo. And so, you know, I mean, she was not afraid to get in there and mix it up. She wasn't the damsel in distress. And it was portrayed perfectly by Carrie Fisher, that character.
I love seeing some of these names, you know, and what they went on to do. And I love researching those types of stories of, like you said, you know, George Lucas is probably the only one that will know, you know, the consideration that was given to those people and how many people were actually considered. But another one that I didn't add to my list, so I'm going to throw this at you, was with Darth Vader, as far as the whole, I guess, creation or behind, there was talk of a samurai, an actor that had been in Japanese movies as a samurai to kind of lend that whole acting side of things to it, because it was still kind of, in the research that I did, it was still kind of undecided as to, you know, what was going to be that whole process for Darth Vader as far as the acting. You know, the voice, obviously, they nailed it. And a little bit of trivia. Do you know, Andy, and I'm sure you do, originally, who Lucas originally intended to be the voice for Darth Vader?
I don't.
Orson Welles.
Ah.
So,
Orson. A good deep voice.
Yep. And then he stopped it because he felt Welles' voice was too familiar. You know, too many people are going to recognize this. And then he went with James Earl Jones, which, like everything else, seemed to work out really well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's few voices around that speak royalty and just power like James Earl Jones. You know, that you couldn't have stuck a better voice under the helmet than that guy's.
Yes, I think that works. And with Darth Vader, you have David Prowse.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know a ton about David Prowse as far as, you know, anything before? Because that was one thing.
He was a weightlifter, a bodybuilder. And so his size specifically is what Lucas was wanting. And Prowse, for the longest time, had no idea that the voice would be dubbed in post-production. He thought he would be, you know, they'd be using his voice. And if you want to see something that's pretty funny, you can probably YouTube videos when they're shooting before the voice is dubbed in. David Prowse is from the UK, so he has an English accent. And for a guy that's 6'7", I believe he was, and built, you know, big guy, he does not have James Earl Jones' voice.
No.
No, Darth Vader would be considerably less imposing as with David Prowse's voice. So, yeah, it was strictly for the the size and to fill out the costume. Not that he didn't do a fantastic job, because, you know, a lot of the mannerisms that Vader had, you know, the when he's talking to Luke and he has the handout on in Empire, you know, when he's talking to him, you know, while Luke's hanging off the out there in one of what Star Wars really enjoys doing is putting up catwalks with no real safety equipment. OSHA would have a field day with a lot of these mile-long catwalks just built for somebody to get thrown off of or fall off of, and these bottomless pits that seem to be all over these space stations. But David Prowse, he made it. It took a lot of people to make Vader, right? It took James Earl Jones' voice. It took David Prowse' stature and his mannerisms and his physique. It took Ben Burtt's sound effects to go ahead and bring in Ralph McQuarrie's drawings to go ahead and bring Darth Vader to life. So, I mean, it really was a community effort to go ahead and make that character what it was. He wouldn't have existed without any one of those pieces as we know him today.
I love the fact that when you realize, so obviously growing up and watching it, I didn't realize, you know, the guy underneath the suit wasn't the guy talking.
Sure.
You know, and so you realize as you get more and more familiar and you learn more about it, you realize what it took, you know, to bring Vader, like you said, to life, just as acting without, you know, without speaking, you know, anything like that, and being able to convey the awesomeness of Vader, you know, in your movements and everything, that walk, you know, mm-hmm. and then just everything about that character, like many things, iconic. And I want to correct something. So I had talked about Vader being considered as somebody with a samurai background, and that was my fault. It was actually Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah,
so, yep,
sure.
Alec Guinness, he was also considered, along with Japanese actor Toshiro Mifune, and I probably mess that up. And he was involved in many Akira Kurosawa films.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And, you know, Star Wars has always leaned heavy on influences from other places. The very nature of them having episodes, which again, really wasn't a thing until the Empire Strikes Back came out, because when Star Wars released, it wasn't episode 4, it was Star Wars.
Yep.
The crawl said Star Wars. Nowadays it says Star Wars Episode 4. But when George Lucas was growing up, there was things called episodic serials or movie serials, which were Flash Gordon. And these would play either before feature films in the movie theater, or like on, you know, just kind of short run little half hour things at the movie theater. And they were episodes. And so that's where George Lucas got his naming of the films episodes. You know, The Mandalorian Season 2, Episode 5, titled The Jedi, is one big love letter to Kurosawa films. That very much is a lone samurai type of story. If you've never seen any of Kurosawa stuff and you want to feel, you know, just the cinematography of it, that is the most beautifully filmed episode of The Mandalorian, is Season 2, Episode 5, called The Jedi. And it's fantastically well directed, acted, and the cinematography in it is just, it's completely miles above anything else, and they're all very good, but that one for me stands out. So yeah, the influence of Star Wars, you know, grabbing from other things, not stealing, but going ahead and an homage to the different genres of film and things that people grew up with. You know, George Lucas didn't have a big hand in it. You know, just kind of consulting, but in Rogue One, I mean, that's very much a Dirty Dozen type
yes.
of yep. type of film. You know, it's It's like that throughout everything. I mentioned the, you know, the Searchers homage that was done in episode two. I sent you a link, like I said, that you can go in and throw in your show notes.
Yeah.
That kind of shows that. But yeah, it comes from everywhere. That's why, you know, one of the things I love about Star Wars is it's not we're Star Wars and we're the best. It's we're Star Wars because of all this other stuff. You know, if I ever made a movie, which I'm not talented enough to do, there'd be, you know, I'd draw heavily from the things that I enjoyed.
Yep.
Star Wars would be one of them. You know, I mean, that's what I know. That's what I like. And I think that's what was done with Star Wars. George Lucas took things from when he was growing up and what he would want to see and made his own version. And I think that anytime you can employ a sense of self and, you're always going to go ahead and work harder when it's something you enjoy. Not that you're going to mail it in on other things, but you're going to give a little bit extra at, you know, anything you do, I feel, if it's something you enjoy, you're going to work the extra hours,
yep.
You know, whether it's a home project, whether it's, you know, anything, you know, a game that you're playing, you know, if you enjoy football more than baseball, you're going to give a little bit more to football. And I think that's really what, you know, what you see with Star Wars and what people are doing now with Star Wars who are making the IP what it is today with Disney.
And those things go into the development of a project, you know, and you can kind of see it. It's a podcast on Disney that I run. So you can kind of see it with that. You know, you had, the 70s and 80s animated films that were just more, hey, let's get them out there before, Eisner, you know, came in, and you had Beauty and the Beast, which kind of made a return to the fantastical, amazing, drawing of animation and getting into the details because it was something that they wanted to get back to.
And did it not use the first computer animation in a hand-drawn animation?
Yep.
I believe the ballroom scene.
Yes.
Dance was aided with computer animation.
Yep. And it was, you know, they wanted to get back to the top and where they were and what got them there. And they dove headfirst into Beauty and the Beast. But that's another podcast for another day, because there will be another one. A side note on Obi-Wan. So Alec Guinness got the part, and he was, as the story goes, one of the few that believed it would be a huge hit. And so his contract called for a percentage, 2.25% of the 1/5 gross royalties paid to Lucas.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that. I knew that he wanted more money because he didn't get it. And after he was contracted, he pretty much hated the dialogue. He was not a fan of the dialogue, wasn't a fan of the story itself, and ended up, you know, a classic case of somebody doing the job they were paid to do. The guy gets an Academy Award winning nomination, Academy Award nomination for something that he didn't truly understand, you know, but he's still the consummate actor, the consummate professional.
Exactly.
You know, went in and did not mail it in.
Yep, and that's what Harrison Ford, in the story I read, he commented on what a professional it was. Always professional, very kind to the other actors, and that's why Lucas went for an established actor for the role of Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, to bring somebody in who's been doing it for a long time that can lead by example, and he did, like you said.
He's a mentor in the story,
yep.
The character is, and a mentor behind the scenes.
So, great choices had by all. Obviously, you've got some other characters, which we'll dive into when we do episode 5. But I wanted to bring in some of those casting options. The movie itself. One thing I wanna ask you, Andy, as you've seen it, give me a ballpark. Episode 4, just ballpark. How many times have you seen it?
Honest to God, it's got to be somewhere, give or take 10, probably 50-ish times, I would bet.
That's a lot. See, even Chewie appreciates that.
Yeah,
they should. One of the questions I have on our outline for the episode today is some of the thoughts from the first times you saw it to your most recent viewing. What are some things that one still hang with you, you know, from the first times you can remember seeing it to the times that you have seen it the latest? And then the things you may not have noticed or the things you may not have paid attention to from early on. And then finally, how do you think the lead in, and that's for this story, and you get a lot of these trilogy films, whether it's Lord of the Rings, you know, The Hobbit, the Harry Potter films, things like that. How effective is their transition into that next movie when you know that there was a next movie in this time? Obviously, you know, when you saw episode 4, oh, is there going to be another one? There might be because it's episode 4. But what do you remember? So take it from the things that stuck with you from the first time to the most recent time.
So from the first times, you know, seeing it, it was just probably at the beginning at that age, it was more along the lines of, my favorite character was always Han Solo.
Yep. I remember
my favorite character. And my favorite ship was the Millennium Falcon. And, you know, the ship designs, were big in the lightsabers. So a lot of the visual aspects of the film were very big to me. That's why I spoke to him earlier. But the ship designs were a lot different from things, you know, that were either real and had to do with space, with, you know, things you'd seen in books with rockets, or, you know, in the advent of 1980, I think might have been the first time the space shuttle went up. You know, they were just a lot different, and it was you were able to enjoy things, I think, a lot more without the internet. You know, you liked something or you didn't, and it was wholly based on what you felt. You know, these days you have things, you've got so many different sources of information that can tell you if you should like something or you shouldn't like something. Back then it was just, I see that, I like it, and it was that simple. So Han Solo, the ships, the blasters, the lightsabers, early on were kind of the favorites. I mean, Darth Vader, obviously, too.
Sure.
And, you know, there was so much to be fleshed out later on. These days when I watch Star Wars, I'm more looking, you know, just as the movie as a film, rather than, because I've seen it so many times, I'm not saying I know absolutely everything or have caught everything, but I can just kind of watch it and, you know, as kind of just the film in as its entirety. I was going to say as it intended to be, but it's changed so much, you know, since it first came out. George Lucas had a habit of doing that, very technical minded guy. And so as technology improved, he wanted to change the film to fit his vision, which, you know, that's a whole nother subject of people getting upset about. But yeah, these days I look at it more as the film as a whole and just kind of watch it. I'm constantly amazed every time a new transfer comes out, you know, with Blu-ray or 4K.
Yep.
And it literally looks like it was filmed yesterday. So I do get caught up in that. One of the things I can't figure out, and there's probably an article that I was just too lazy to look up, is the, rotoscoping. So I don't know if you know what that is. Being a Disney fan, you might. So rotoscoping is a technique that may have been pioneered, and I might get this wrong, on Snow White. It was definitely pioneered in animation, to where they would film an actor or an actress doing the motions, you know, a dance or, you know, the form. So if you look at a film like Snow White or a lot of the Disney stuff, particularly the early stuff, you're going to find that, and then you put on something like I was going to say Saturday morning cartoons, but there's maybe a big part of your audience that has no idea what that means. You know, something like G.I. Joe when we were growing up, or the Transformers, or He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, these animated shows that ran in the afternoons after school. And you look at the animation difference. Snow White has a very real kind of motion, a very fluid. The animation is very smooth. Well, the rotoscoping is basically going over the top of what the actress did and copying the motions, animating over the top of that. So rotoscoping with the lightsaber is a little different, but that's how the lightsabers were done in episode four, is rotoscoping. So it was kind of drawn over the film.
Yeah.
I, for the life of me, for all the technical changes that have been made, that Lucas made, you know, and this, these are some of the things that when I was watching it, not recently, but back when he was making a lot of the changes, that, that always kind of bugged me. You know, he would do things like make Mos Eisley, where they meet Han Solo in episode four, bigger, because he always had it described as this major, like, commercial hub on Tatooine. And, you know, with the physical sets, he couldn't make it as big as he wanted to. So he added later on CGI effects showing more ships coming in,
yeah,
a bigger city, more people, that type of thing. He added more creatures in Mos Eisley, Oronto. He added more dewbacks. You know, he had like physical built dewback that kind of looks like a big lizard that does, that are ridden around the desert, that just kind of stood by the cantina because they were just props. But he added, you know, animated those, brought in, you know, one of the more recognizable scenes is when he added Jabba the Hutt into episode four.
Yep.
Which was, you know, actually filmed with an actor that they never, they'd filmed that in 77, but, or 76, and never used it. And it was an actor. It was a big guy in furs that was Jabba the Hutt. But Lucas, that was one of the things he struck out where he was like, yeah, this isn't, you know, this isn't Jabba the Hutt. So he just took that out completely, then went back to the film, re-edited it. And basically they CGI'd a version of what we know as Jabba over the top of the actor. And so used it that way. But to me, when Luke first ignites that lightsaber in Ben Kenobi's dwelling, and then when he lights it on the Millennium Falcon to use the training droid, it looks white, you know? And I just, you know, I thought, my God, how hard is that to give it the blue tint? That one thing out of everything has bugged me probably more than anything else. And I, you know, that every time I watch it, I see that I'm just like, really? Can't turn it blue. But you know, that's a lot of the things that have changed. You know, one of the cool things that technology has allowed that I think George would have done himself, but somebody came up with, is in these later 7, 8, and 9, speaking to the lightsabers, let me jump back. Episodes 1, 2, and 3, the blades were CGI'd over, and they were stunt blades. And if you had a green lightsaber, it was a green blade. If you had a red lightsaber, it was a red blade. But they didn't light. You know, they were made to go ahead and hit against each other and whatnot. And that was all fixed in post with the lighting added, the CGI adding the blades, the glowing to the blades. Well, in episode 7, 8, and 9, they have, and you can find them online, they're, you know, and I don't know if they're the same thing, but like dueling sabers,
yep,
you know, that are built to go ahead and hit against each other. So they use a variation of that. And so when they were filming, they were actually glowing. Now, again, they're going to enhance those after the film to get them to glow the way they want on screen.
Yeah.
But what that did was, when you got close-ups of the actors fighting with each other, you got the red reflection off their face, or the blue reflection off their face. You got the true the shading on their face from that. And when the lightsabers would collide, it would flash, so you would get that on there. So just some little things like that may not be well known, but, you know, just speak to like the technical aspects of what was being done, because Star Wars has always been kind of at the forefront of the special effects.
Oh yeah. Yep.
So, you know, that's what I was looking at for a long time, but these days I look more at just enjoying the film and how the waiting for my next favorite line that's coming up.
And with the before we get into the transition, when it, you know, how it ended, as far as, you know, was that a good ending that led into the beginning of five? Let's talk about the actual story. I'm going to go ahead and bypass the spoiler alert for obvious reasons.
Okay.
Yeah. If you haven't seen Star Wars and you need a spoiler alert, then yeah, this,
unsubscribe.
Yeah. Yep. Delete. But, the story, how do you think in 4, 5, and 6, obviously, you know, your favorite trilogy of the three trilogies, and
yeah,
and you know, it has, you know, probably, you know, those three are in what, your top five of all Star Wars movies, you know, those three.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, including, you know, like you had mentioned when you were on before, the Clone Wars and things like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think about this story? So, the story of episode 4, which, like you said, was originally in 77 when it came out, it was just Star Wars, and it wasn't until 81 that it was A New Hope. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about this story itself when you compare it to the original three?
Ask that question again.
Yeah, what do you think about how do you feel about the story, the actual plot, you know, in conjunction of, not only did we talk about introduce so many great things, but how do you think the story holds up for this movie when you compare it to 5 and 6?
I think the story is a story that's been told many times, you know, before and since. It's a underdog good versus evil story, just with a different skin. And that doesn't mean, again, it's copying anything. It's a different take on that sure. story. You know, I mean, you see it in mythology. You see it in the Bible. You see it in countless films. It's just, you know, different characters. You know, Star Wars, as much as it's labeled sci-fi, I think George Lucas has even said it's a fantasy film.
Yeah, yep.
Very akin to the Lord of the Rings. You know, in Lord of the Rings, you have Gandalf, the wise old mentor. In Star Wars, you have Obi-Wan Kenobi, and you have a quest. So that story, you know, everything hinges on that one story, right? If this story doesn't take off, there is no episode 5. There's no episode 6. You know, there's no Star Wars universe if this thing fails. You know, if this thing comes out and it's the last Starfighter, it's the last Starfighter movie. And you don't see the last Starfighter part 2.
Too soon. Too soon.
Yeah. So, but, you know, it did that. It launched these other sci-fi films too. And, you know, I'd be disingenuous if I didn't go ahead and tip my cap to, as a Star Wars fan, to Gene Roddenberry.
Yes.
And Star Trek.
Yep.
You know, I mean, and George Lucas will tell you that. So, you know, it's never an us versus them. It's just, you know, what do you enjoy? And people really enjoyed that take of what was done with the underdog good versus evil story. And a lot of that had to do with, like I said, the tech, but a lot of it had to do with the relationships of the characters and how the characters were brought to life. So, you know, I think, you know, all these years later, we're sitting here and, you know, there's a whole section of Disney World and Disneyland dedicated to this film that a guy financed himself and, you know, is the most popular entertainment franchise film-wise of all time to me.
It's that land is amazing. They I think they lived up to expectations with, I'll say, the casual fans. Like you said, there's a lot of toxicity in Star Wars fans, and you'll get those that aren't happy with what Disney did with Bantu over in Galaxy's Edge. But with casual fans that, you know, go and just become immersed in it, I've been there once, and I was in love. You know, I thought all the interaction, even with COVID, it's just going to get better and better. And so, you know, with the story, you know, you introduce obviously Princess Leia. You know, she gets captured. You know, she R2-D2. She puts the plans in there, and then you meet Luke. The job was sell the droids, right? They sell 3PO and R2.
Yeah, the droids basically, they have to escape with those plans. They get launched in a escape pod, and it's R2-D2 that has kind of, he's the brains of the operation. He knows what's going on. And I like to think it's because, you know, Leia obviously has worked with him before, and you know, he's just, he has a job to do and doesn't talk too much about it. C-3PO just, you know, R2-D2 could have went on his own and did this. C-3PO just happened to come along because of the situation. And, you know, he, throughout the stories, you know, it's always him talking too much. People telling him to shut up, you know, Han Solo, shut him up or shut him down.
Yep.
You know, that type of thing. So, R2-D2 gets the plans from Leia and has to go ahead and get him to Obi-Wan Kenobi. So they escape in an escape craft, and head to Tatooine, which they're over right there, and land in the desert. R2-D2 and C-3PO split up in the desert because they're arguing. R2 goes one way, C-3PO goes another. They end up in the Jawa Sandcrawler, getting picked up by the scavengers, the Jawas, and are basically, the Jawas are a traveling junk sale.
Yep.
And they go ahead and they sell to the far points of Tatooine, which is a desert planet. And one of the big industries there is moisture farming. And so that's how they come into the hands of Luke Skywalker and his aunt and uncle. And R2, the Jawas, affix the droids with restraining bolts so they don't, you know, wander off, because these droids are sentient and they can go ahead and have minds of their own. And so the restraining bolt keeps them from, like, you know, it's like a shock collar.
Yeah.
They can't go anywhere with those bolts on. So R2, tricks Luke into, taking off the restraining bolt when Luke sees part of the message that Leia sent, and he wants to see the whole message. And R2-3PO tells Luke that R2-D2 said the restraining bolt might be shorting out his playback system, and if you took it off, he could probably replay the whole message. Well, he takes it off. He doesn't play the whole message, but it's getting late, so he has to shut the power down and go to bed. So he comes back a little later after eating, and R2's gone. They can't look for him during the day or during the night. It's too dangerous, so they leave first thing in the morning to go find him, track him down, attacked by sand people. Obi-Wan Kenobi finds them before the sand people kill him, and takes him back. 3PO lost an arm. They get that repaired. That's where Obi-Wan Kenobi basically tells Luke about his father, and sees the entire message that Leia sends, and tells him that you know, you should come with me to do this. And Luke has been trying to get off that farm for a long time. He wanted to join the academy to go ahead and fight against the Empire. And his uncle keeps, you know, kind of pausing that. There's things to this that we don't know until the prequels. You know, why is this and why is this that? And you know, so you just take them at face value for what they are at that point. So while Luke's gone, he's taking Obi-Wan Kenobi to Mos Eisley, or maybe Anchorhead is where he was going to take him, because it was kind of on the way. And they come across all the burned out Jawas that were attacked by the stormtroopers. And Luke thinks that if the Imperials attacked those Jawas because they thought they picked up C-3PO and R2-D2 who had the plans, they might attract them back home. So they go there. His aunt and uncle are dead. And so he decides to join Ben Kenobi. They go ahead and they need a ship to get to Alderaan, which is Princess Leia's home planet. And they meet Han Solo, hire him. They escape there once the Imperials are track him down and head out towards Alderaan. More of the story about Jedi and whatnot on the ship. They're in hyperspace. They come out of hyperspace in the Alderaan sector, and the planet's gone. The Death Star, the new Imperial planet space station, has a planet-killing weapon on it that's more powerful than anything that anybody's ever seen, and it's decided to test it on Leia's home planet with her watching, because she won't give up the details of those plans that the rebels stole. So then it becomes a rescue mission for Leia. They go to the Death Star. They get, they find Leia, rescue her. Obi-Wan faces Vader, ends up quote unquote, dying, to Vader on the Death Star. The plans are sent to the Rebel Alliance, or delivered to the Rebel Alliance. They find a weak point at the Death Star, again, foreshadowing to stuff that you end up finding out later. And, big battle, underdog battle, the ships, the little rebel ships versus the Death Star, and use the weak point, blow up the Death Star. Cool John Williams score at the end. Chewbacca doesn't get a medal. It's a controversy for years, and ends on a high note.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah, what's up with that, man? I mean, Chewie was there. I mean, he's the first mate.
Just as much.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had to wait a long time to get a medal.
Yeah, what a bunch of crap. That's the synopsis as done by Andy Rood. Very succinct and precise. And I'm glad that we were able to dive into episode 4. One last character that I wanted to just mention briefly and get your thoughts on, because we talked about Harrison Ford being Han Solo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just, you know, the way he got the part and everything. Peter Cushing, as Grand Moff Tarkin, he just looks like an evil dude. I mean, he looks like...
No, they got the right guy for that.
Yeah.
They got the right guy for that. Again, you know, physical performance as much as anything else, and he does that. Again, Star Wars being a franchise that really adopts new technology... brings him back to life in Rogue One.
Yes.
You know, Tarkin is a big part of Rogue One.
Yep.
And, Peter Cushing had passed away 20 years ago or something like that when Rogue One came out. And so they got the blessing from the family and whatnot. And it was a team of CGI artists, an actor, to be in there that looked similar to they could go ahead and CGI the image of Peter Cushing over, and then a voice actor. So, yeah, I mean, that's Star Wars always trying out the new tech.
That's awesome. I mean, just being able to do stuff like that, you know, even having the ability to, you know what, we'll talk about that one on another episode, because I know, I know it'll elicit a response from you, and that's what I'm all about. But closing thoughts on Star Wars Episode 4. For me, it was just the ability to be successful in so many different areas and the ability to maintain its legacy some, what are we, 40, 45 years, 44 years later. What about you? Final thoughts on episode 4 when it comes to just your view?
It's my favorite Star Wars film. A lot of people like Empire better.
Yep.
Which that's not a knock against Empire, but for me, this is a film that introduced me to these characters that I love. And you know, it just, you know, when you have to introduce characters and flesh them out all in 2 hours, it's tough. Something gets shortchanged, but you really get the feeling of knowing these characters in the short time that you spend with them in this film. And they all get their moment, the main three. And you know, for me, it's just that you're taking a journey with these droids, with Luke Skywalker, right up through the end. You know, I at the time especially, I don't think there's a lot of people who haven't been doing something, been in school, being at a job, you know, maybe their first or second job that they want to aspire to do more, that hasn't stopped for a minute and just thought, man, I wish I could be doing this. That's his story. You know, that's Luke Skywalker's story. I want to be doing something more, whatever that is. And it's just a great journey type of film. And so for me, that, you know, it gets the stakes are unquestionably high in it. And it's just, it's not anything like you mentioned before with like galactic trade law.
Yes. Yes. You know, the intricacies of galactic trade law.
Right. So it's underdog, good versus evil, and, you know, great adventure film.
Excellent. And Chewie had his closing remarks.
Yeah.
Big fan. Big fan.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Excellent. Andy, thank you again. Before
yeah, you're welcome.
Before I list all the ways that you can get in touch with me, why don't you just give us a little bit about This Won't Teach You Anything and how you can get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. First off, I appreciate you having me. This Won't Teach You Anything is basically a pop culture podcast where we cover anything related to pop culture, film, music, collecting, you name it, we talk about it. So it's not always Star Wars, of course. The first one that I did was Star Wars, and Star Wars does make its way into a lot of the episodes. But, you know, we'll talk about anything and everything having to do with entertainment and pop culture. And you can follow the show on Twitter at This Won't Teach, Instagram, this_won't_teach_you_anything, email thiswon'tteach@gmail.com, and Facebook at This Won't Teach. So yeah, if you want to hear me ramble on about things that basically won't teach you anything of value, then go ahead, rate, review, and subscribe, and look forward to talking your ear off about something that you may or may not care about.
And that's what we want with these podcasts. Just some time killing, some stuff to enjoy. And with Rudy's Roundup, as always, we're on Facebook. Our page is Rudy's Roundup. You can email the show, rudysroundup@gmail.com. We're on Instagram at Rudy's Roundup. And finally, we're on Twitter at Rudy's Roundup. So just as with This Won't Teach You Anything, make sure to like and subscribe to the page for any and all updates. I try to continue on Facebook to post updates regarding the show, but also Disney updates around the world. Thank you guys, as always, for tuning in. From the bottom of my heart, I appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to me and my guests, whoever they may be, or if it's just me solo talking about, get it, solo? There it is.
Nice.
Thank you.
Well played.
Talking about anything and everything Disney. We'll be back next time to, I don't know, talk about something Disney, and we'll see how it goes from there. Thank you all again, and we'll see you real soon.